The director of Maine's CDC answers your questions about the coronavirus. The number of confirmed COVID-19 cases in Maine continues to grow, and tests remain limited. In the past 24 hours, the CDC has upgraded Maine's status to a state with moderate community transmission. That means there is now widespread and/or sustained transmission of COVID-19 and potential for rapid increase. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, the director of Maine's Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Dr. Nirav Shah, joins us. He will update us on the new guidelines for testing and self-isolation, as well as the latest number of cases. We will be on the air for the next 2 hours with Dr. Shah. He will try to answer as many of your questions as possible. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today, we have a special two-hour program. Dr. Nirav Shah, director of the Maine Center for Disease Control and Prevention, is with us to share the latest information about COVID-19 in Maine and to answer your questions. Dr. Shah joins us from our Augusta studio. Dr. Shah, thank you so much for being here with us today.
It's my pleasure. I'm really excited to be able to chat with everyone and answer all the questions we can today.
Well, and as always, we do want to hear from you. Are you concerned about testing for the virus? What questions do you have about self-isolation or the spread of coronavirus? You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Please be patient. We've already had dozens of emails coming in and many other questions in by voicemail and other means. And I just want to make a note that, you know, no question is too dumb. Don't feel as though you're asking something that's going to make you look dumb, because other people will have the same question. But I will ask, please be considerate of Dr. Shah's time as well as the other listeners who want to get through. Dr. Shah, I understand you just had a briefing. Please give us the latest figures on the number of people who have tested positive for COVID-19 in Maine. And how about negative tests as well?
As of right now, there are 56 individuals in Maine who have tested positive for COVID-19. That's an increase in 8 cases since yesterday. So we're continuing to see an increase in the number of cases, not just in Maine, but across New England, across the country. At the same time that there have been an increase in cases, there's also been an increase in testing. So as of this morning, approximately 2,200 people in Maine have also tested negative. That being said, we fully expect over the coming days, over the coming weeks, that there will be additional cases of COVID-19 across the state. And we really do urge everyone to start taking measures that we can discuss more over the next 2 hours to try to make sure they're doing everything they can to protect themselves and their family.
And sure, Dr. Shah, are these numbers concerning or unexpected to you?
These numbers are expected, by which I mean the Maine CDC has been looking at, studying, and preparing for the arrival of coronavirus since late December, when in the international community started receiving reports of this atypical pneumonia starting in China and started wondering what the implications might be if it were to spread throughout China, across Asia, and now across the globe. So these numbers and the arrival of coronavirus in Maine are what we have been planning and preparing for. Our job now is to try to, recognizing that the virus is here and that it is at least spreading in at least Cumberland County on a community level basis, our job now is to try to what we call flatten the curve, to try to minimize the impact of the virus on the healthcare system as much as possible so that people who are ill, people who need medical attention, can get that as quickly as possible.
State epidemiologist Dr. Siri Bennett issued a public health advisory yesterday evening based on the fact that Maine now has enough cases of COVID-19 to meet a certain federal definition of, quote, moderate community transmission. What does this mean?
Moderate community transmission is defined by the United States Center for Disease Control as a level of spread that reaches on a per-person basis above a certain threshold. So low spread, or the category that we were in just several days ago, is largely marked by individuals who have COVID-19 who are the result of travel from other countries, someone who may have traveled to Italy or South Korea and who returns to Maine and is diagnosed here in Maine. Moderate transmission, which is the category that we are in now, is marked not only by people who have the cases and who are coming in because of travel, but also some degree of what is called community transmission. Community transmission is really similar to how we think about the flu. It means that we're not quite sure, or we are not able to connect any individual's case of coronavirus to, say, having returned from travel to Italy or having had direct contact with another person with coronavirus. For some cases that we have right now in Cumberland County, it's likely that they probably picked it up from just being around in their daily lives. So the combination of some travel-associated cases with some of these community cases places Maine in this moderate category.
And what does that mean on a practical level for healthcare providers?
Well, what it means is two things. The first is that healthcare providers of all stripes, whether they be emergency medical personnel, our vital first-line responders out in the field, as well as healthcare providers in outpatient and hospital settings, should recognize that a patient that might be before them who has the signs and symptoms of COVID-19, that's a cough, a fever, chest pain because they're having difficulty breathing. Healthcare providers recognize that even if that patient might not have traveled, say, to Italy, they might actually have COVID-19. That is to say, when we reach this moderate level, we want healthcare providers to include COVID-19 in the list of diagnoses that they are considering. That's really why we wanted to send that release out as soon as possible. The second thing it means is that we need to focus the healthcare community's efforts on patients that we believe to be of the highest risk for COVID-19. Those are folks who are in the hospital. Those are folks who might live in congregate settings like long-term care facilities. So we wanted to make sure that we communicated with healthcare providers that those folks who live in those high-risk settings, that's where we are really, really focusing our diagnostic attention on.
Well, let's talk about testing a little bit. There's been so much attention to this. Would you have to prioritize these patients if there were more testing kits available nationwide?
In a world in which testing kits were an absolutely unlimited resource, then prioritization might even still happen. Here's why. The way that tests for respiratory diseases like coronavirus work are that we have to make sure that someone has symptoms, first and foremost. If you test someone who doesn't have symptoms, we don't really know what that test means. It could be that they weren't exposed to the virus at all. It also might mean, if they test negative, that the virus just hasn't copied itself and expanded in someone's body enough to start causing symptoms. So even in that world, there is still some prioritization. But now that we're at a moderate level, where transmission or spread, as we call it, is happening in the community, we also have to make sure that healthcare providers are zeroed in on this highest risk group of people. That's folks who are at the hospital. That's folks who might be living in a nursing home, things like that. So we can get results back to those doctors as quickly as we can to try to alleviate whatever healthcare problems they might have.
What is our current testing capacity?
Right now, the Maine CDC laboratory here in Augusta can run approximately 200 samples per day. However, nationwide, there have been challenges getting some of the ingredients that we need to conduct testing. When I think about laboratory testing, I sort of in my own mind equate it to something like baking. There are a lot of things that you need in order to bake. You need an oven, and that is kind of similar to the hardware that we have in our laboratory that runs the tests themselves. You also need a lot of equipment. You need containers where the samples go in and such things. That's kind of similar to the baking dishes you might use. You also need the ingredients. And those ingredients right now, those are things that are similar to the flour and the sugar that you might use while baking. right now on a nationwide level, there are concerns about the supply of some of those ingredients. One of the ones that we're concerned about the most right now are what are called reagents. Reagents are essentially the enzymes that are used in the testing process to make the entire thing go. And right now, on a national level, there's a concern about the shortage of those reagents. The team at the Maine CDC laboratory here in Augusta has been, for weeks now, putting in orders to try to stay as much as we can ahead of the curve. But as the nationwide shortage of these reagents continues, our concern level rises. But what I can tell you right now is that our team has been staying on top of this. We've gone so far as to reach out to other great partners across the state, well-known scientific groups like the Jackson Laboratories and IDEX and the university systems, to try to see if we can get some of these ingredients from them so that we can continue testing as uninterrupted as possible. That being said, it is a challenge right now.
So processing about 200 a day, how many are on hand ready to go for the immediate future?
Right now, where we are right now is that we have approximate, but it really does depend on how many additional samples come in and how providers prioritize them and how our laboratory accession, takes them in and catalogs them, which is called accessioning. But that being said, right now we have samples for approximately 1,100 tests. We really want to make sure that we are focusing on those highest risk groups so that we can get results back to doctors who are taking care of patients in the hospitals, doctors and other healthcare providers who are working with patients in long-term care settings, and healthcare providers as well.
The Maine CDC's health advisory also includes new recommendations for how self-isolation is carried out. One part is that for those who have already tested positive and are managing symptoms while in self-isolation, have we already had a few cases of these people who have tested positive and now recovered?
We have. We have had one individual who tested positive and has now recovered from the disease. And that's a good sign. It mirrors what has happened in other parts of the world, where as more and more individuals are diagnosed, we've also learned that many of them, approximately 80%, have a mild illness. Now, I recognize that that is cold comfort for the 20% who have more severe illness, and we work with them and always wish them the best. That being said, for that 80% who have a more mild illness, as they recover throughout the course of their illness, they move into that box of recovered individuals. Right now in Maine, we have one such individual.
All right. Let's talk about some recommendations for, one, people who don't believe they have symptoms, and two, people who have symptoms but are not able to get a test. What are your recommendations for those two groups of people? What is the very current thinking?
So for folks who have symptoms, and again, these symptoms are cough, fever, shortness of breath, perhaps chest pain. Some new data came out last night that many people might also have gastrointestinal symptoms, a little bit of vomiting. For those folks, if you think that you might have coronavirus, especially if you are just returning from travel from a part of the world or nowadays even a part of the country where there are a lot of coronavirus cases circulating, if you have those symptoms, the best thing to do, the first thing to do, is to make sure you stay at home and what we call self-isolate. That allows you to limit the number of people that you come into close contact with and thus limit the spread. So as soon as you start feeling those symptoms, and especially if you've just returned from a trip to one of those parts of the globe, please stay at home and self-isolate. The second thing to do is to reach out to your healthcare provider. Your healthcare provider can guide you on the next best steps. Given that we've seen data now over the past several months that suggests that healthy individuals who have coronavirus disease can stay home, the U.S. CDC is starting to shift its guidance for such individuals to say that you might need to get a test, but you might not need to get a test. The reason for that is that even if we tested you, the management of your illness wouldn't change. The recommendation would still be to stay home, take care of yourself and avoid exposing as many people as possible by staying inside, not going to work. That guidance is shifting very rapidly at the federal level, and we in Maine are keeping tabs on it on an almost daily basis. It changes. And so when those guidance documents change, we always try to alert healthcare providers. But to recap, if you've just returned from a part of the world with coronavirus and you have those symptoms, the best thing to do is to make sure you stay home and then reach out to your healthcare provider for advice on what the next step should be.
What about the rest of us?
So for the rest of us, the best thing that we can all do right now is a few things. The first, do all the things at this time of the year that you would otherwise be doing to stay healthy. Eat a good diet. Make sure you're getting enough sleep. Try to exercise when you can. Get your flu shot if you haven't gotten that already. It is still not too late. But the second thing for folks who don't yet have who do not have coronavirus is to practice what a lot of folks now call social distancing. But honestly, when I think about social distancing, what I really think about is physical distancing. And that's simply trying to introduce as much space between you and other people around you. The way that coronavirus spreads is through respiratory droplets, the things that you might sneeze out or cough out if you have a really, really deep cough. By introducing as much space as possible between you and other people, you disrupt the natural transmission flow of the virus. You make it so that the virus, even if you sneeze, can't land on another person and be inhaled. Now, a lot of folks, the CDC, refer to this as social distancing, and that's correct. But when I think about it, what I really think about is physical distancing. Because at a time like this, when there's fear, there's uncertainty, what I don't want to happen is for an epidemic of coronavirus to turn into an epidemic of loneliness. So what I ask everyone to do is to practice this physical distancing, but at the same time, increase the amount of social connection that you have. Maybe that's through different means. Maybe that's through using FaceTime and teaching your relatives how to use FaceTime finally. Maybe that's by calling an old friend. Maybe that's by writing somebody a letter. Anything that we can do to increase that social connectedness at a time when we're introducing more physical distance, I think will help all of us manage what's going on.
And that really is one of the trickiest things in all this, isn't it, Dr. Shaw, that we need each other as human beings, and being told to stay away from one another is very, very hard for many people.
We are social creatures by our nature, and many of the recommendations that the Maine CDC, that Governor Mills, and the U.S. CDC are making are hard. Let's acknowledge that. Asking people to stay away from one another, to avoid groups of 10 or more, that is not what we are about at our base. And I fully acknowledge how difficult that is. And I think, Jennifer, this is a great time to pause and recognize and commend and congratulate all the Maine people who have heeded these recommendations. I mentioned a little while ago that I spoke to a friend of mine last night who said that walking down the streets in Portland, they were vacant at 6 o'clock. That's hard. But it's also where we are right now in order to get a handle on this. And I just want to commend everybody for this act of good citizenship. It is not easy. It will certainly get better, but it will get better because we are taking these hard steps right now. But let's not let this become an epidemic of loneliness. Let's keep that social connection. Physical distance does not mean, for example, you can't go outside. You can still go outside and go for a walk. But it might mean that you might have to avoid some of the locations that you might have otherwise gone to for social support, social clubs, bars, civic gatherings. That might be a challenge right now. I fully recognize that. But it's where we are, and because of these actions that we're taking, that's what's going to allow us to get through this on the other side.
Well, we have so many questions coming in, many of them about social distancing, but we do need to take a quick break. When we come back, your questions for Dr. Nirav Shaw. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Major support of Maine Calling's special coverage is provided by the Damariscotta River Grill, now offering takeout and curbside pickup for those wishing to stay home. Menus available at damerscotteriverGrill.com. Androscoggin Home Healthcare and Hospice, with expanded services in Augusta, including pediatric care and telehealth. More at androscoggin.org. And Dean's Sweets, specializing in hand-dipped nut-free chocolates, in Portland's Old Port and in their new location on Cove Street. deanssweets.com.
Most major sports have canceled events for the foreseeable future, but the Summer Olympics, it's still on.
By telling athletes to continue to go out and train, all they're doing is mixing messages with the restrictions that are being put in place by governments around the world that are being hit by coronavirus.
Olympics and the coronavirus, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And that's coming up later today at 4 here on Maine Public Radio. You've no doubt heard the alert's tones before, as the emergency alert system advises you that in the case of an emergency, an important message would follow. Because of Maine Public's statewide infrastructure, we serve as the statewide backbone of this important service and distribute the alerts to all other stations around the state. This is a valuable and important public service that informs, alerts, and warns the people of Maine when situations warrant.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we have Dr. Nirav Shah with the Maine Center for Disease Control and Prevention with us to offer updates on COVID-19 and to answer your questions. We invite you to join Maine Calling at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Dr. Shah, before the break, we were talking about social distancing, so I will start with a question. This is an email from Mary. Is it safe to walk with a friend outside if we are staying several feet apart?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, Mary. Even though, again, these are difficult times and these are new challenges that we are all facing by being told to socially distance or physically distance, one can still go outside. Putting some space between you and anyone you might be walking with is always a good idea right now. If that individual or you happen to not be feeling well, I would recommend staying inside. But provided you don't have any symptoms, going on a walk with your friend is fine. That's what I do every evening with my wife and our dog. We still have to get outside and we still have to let that monster get his exercise as well. So we are absolutely doing so. It's a glorious time of the year in Maine, and social distancing does not mean becoming a hermit. So please enjoy the outdoors.
Okay, how about going over to a friend's house and watching a movie if you sit in separate chairs or across the room from one another?
I think it's a judgment call. If everyone is feeling okay, no one has any symptoms, and it's a small handful of people in a large room, again, we still have to stay socially connected. It's really physical distancing, not so much socially distancing. But if it's a small room with 10 or more people, lots of individuals, some of whom might not be feeling well, I would recommend against that. This is a situation that, because it can be a serious disease, it might be prudent, if something is on the margin and it's a difficult judgment call, it might be prudent to pass on it. But provided it's a large room, everyone is feeling well, we still have to maintain that social connectedness.
All right. We'll go to Anne Marie, who's calling from Westbrook. Hi, Anne Marie. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. While I appreciate the distancing and have been practicing it, I said, why have there been no federal guidelines for large businesses whose employees work in small areas who are non-essential, but yet who are still expected to come to work every day? Because it's when you're expected to show up at work, but your job has been suspended and your job functions are suspended, but you're still being required to show up in an area that is really congested where people cannot practice 6 feet of social distancing. I'm just curious why there hasn't been a mandate from the government that these companies that can afford to send their employees home and let them be at home and still receive the compensation hasn't been done.
All right, Anne-Marie, thanks for your question.
Anne-Marie, that's a great question, and I can't speak to where things are at the federal level. But certainly, you know, our concern, of course, first and foremost, is for the health of everybody, certainly employees. The way that we've been thinking about this is, to the extent possible, where a particular entity is a non-essential function, a business that doesn't have a vital role, that's an entity that might need to encourage employees to work from home, for example. But we do that recognizing that not everyone can work from home. And so I know that the governor has been very focused on trying to ease that transition for folks to ensure that individuals who might be temporarily displaced, for example, can obtain unemployment benefits more quickly, so on and so forth. So it is absolutely a challenge. It's also a balance. But we fully recognize, and I certainly recognize that in different situations with different workplaces, more folks might be more closely packed in. And so this is a territory in which many of the things that we're asking folks to do haven't really been done before on a scale like this in the United States. So there are a lot of adjustments that are being made midstream. When we see new situations crop up, when the team at the Maine CDC senses that there needs to be something that we need to get involved in, we're standing by to assist, whether it's an employer or a healthcare institution, to manage that. You raise a great point, and I think it's something that's really under discussion right now.
Anne Marie, thank you so much for calling in, and we will go to Joan, who is also calling from Cumberland County. Hi, Joan. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to say I'm in an area where there's a high concentration of positive people. Someone went on a trip and came back, and then, like, every day there are more and more people that are coming down with us. So in an effort to keep in contact with my neighbors, I have found out that there are various symptoms, even within the population that is testing positive. Now, last night I heard that there may be a new development concerning symptoms where there is intestinal symptoms that also occur. Now, some of the people that I've spoken to don't have the high fever, but they may have intestinal symptoms. And they, you know, with some of the other symptoms, but they have been tested positive, but they have it to a lesser degree than some of the other people around me who are experiencing really violent reactions to this COVID-19.
So, Joan, thank you so much for your call. And Dr. Shah, you did mention that before. You mentioned vomiting. Is that the intestinal symptom that we may be seeing, or could it be other intestinal symptoms as well?
So yesterday evening, there were data that were just published that suggested that even for some patients, not all patients, but for some patients, the very first presenting symptoms that they had were not the more classical fever, shortness of breath, but rather GI symptoms. So this would include vomiting, nausea, or diarrhea. That's not for all patients by any means, but it was an observation that came out of some data that were just published yesterday. We generally think that for respiratory type diseases, the very first things that you would experience would be that cough, that fever, that shortness of breath. But it turns out with coronavirus, for some fraction, not all, but a fraction of people, the very first symptoms they have can be gastrointestinal. And then after that, about a day after that, followed by the more classical respiratory symptoms. You know, really, Jennifer and Joan, this speaks to how quickly the science around coronavirus is really moving. Keep in mind that just a couple of months ago, 3 months ago, coronavirus was just a blip on the radar for a few infectious disease epidemiologists across the globe. And now, just 3 months later, there is so much more that's known than just 90 days ago. And as this goes on, we will continue to learn more about the coronavirus. One of the scientific achievements that has marked the coronavirus work thus far is how quickly the virus was identified, how quickly its genetic DNA fingerprint was coded and put online, and how quickly that allowed the scientific research community to immediately jump into action and start working on a vaccine, to start testing therapies. That is an unprecedented amount of scientific progress that's been made internationally in about 90 days.
Wow. Well, Joan, thank you for your good question. I want to follow up on that, Dr. Shah. You said first this small group of people has shown first gastrointestinal symptoms and then a day or two later the respiratory symptoms. If someone's listening to this and thinks, I've had some gastrointestinal symptoms in the past week or so, if they were not followed up with respiratory symptoms, does that person likely not have COVID-19?
That is a great question, Jennifer. And the answer, based on what we know right now, which is, as we said, changing on an almost daily basis, if someone just uniquely had gastrointestinal symptoms, no respiratory symptoms, no cough, no fever, it's less likely that what they have is coronavirus and more likely that what they had was a bit of an upset stomach from many of the other things that can cause GI symptoms. However, there are no absolutes, and we may learn in the future that there are some segments of people whose only symptoms for coronavirus are just gastrointestinal. That's not where we are in the research right now. So if that person just had the nausea and the vomiting and that wasn't followed by any kind of respiratory symptoms, their likelihood of having had coronavirus is much lower, but it's not zero. It's more likely that they had a more traditional stomach bug.
All right. I have an email here from Susan. In regards to quarantines, I live in a small two-unit apartment building, first and second floors. If one of the apartments has to be quarantined, does the other also have to be quarantined, or is it just a household that has to quarantine?
Great question, because we think about this a lot in terms of how we should manage individuals and work with individuals who live in apartments. And right now, the way that because of how this virus spreads, what we know is that individuals who are in an apartment building, so in this case, one apartment on the ground floor, one apartment on the top floor, if the person on the top floor needed to be quarantined at home to watch for symptoms for 2 weeks, the person on the ground floor does not need to be quarantined. They do and should, however, avoid contact with the person on the top floor. That's just the nature of quarantine. The person up top shouldn't really be walking around, shouldn't really be out anyways, so it should happen automatically. But just because one person in an apartment building is quarantined by health officials does not mean that everybody else in the building does need to be. And that's because of how the virus spreads. It really does spread by those respiratory droplets that occur when you sneeze within a couple of feet of somebody.
All right. Well, we'll go to McGinley calling from Lubeck. Hi, McGinley. Go ahead.
Hey. So my husband and I have a place where people come to drink. And before, like the week before St. Patty's Day, we canceled and said we were going to be closed. We're going to close the restaurant. And then just last week, we said we're not going to serve bottles out of our place, which a lot of breweries are. We're a brewery. And part of that is because we're witnessing people in our community not following the recommendations of the Maine CDC or the federal CDC as far as restricting distance from each other and such. And it's really worrisome because I'm seeing people in the grocery store and everywhere just pretty much going about business as usual. And it's not, you know, that all that hype about it being like the flu and all that apparently has made quite an impact on people locally. And I can name like 10 people I know in the past 2 weeks who have returned from Italy, Portugal, other places that have outbreaks, and they're in our town and in our county. And I'm wondering if maybe the numbers might help register. Like, is there any indication? Does anybody know how many respirators we actually have in Washington County at the Calais Regional Hospital and at Downeast Community Hospital, our two hospitals serving 3.5 hours worth of residents? How many respirators we have. So if people get sick, like what's their chance of getting on a respirator if they have to?
Yeah, McGinley, thank you. And a whole lot there, Dr. Shaw. But first is guidance for people who are listening who have come back from a foreign country in the last couple weeks.
So let's start with that category, folks. If you've come back from a foreign country, what I would ask you to do is check the US CDC's website. And there is a section there for guidance for returning travelers. And on that section of the website, they list a certain number of countries for whom, if you have just returned from, the recommendation of the U.S. CDC, the Maine CDC, is that you stay home and inside for 2 weeks. That's what's known as self-quarantining. It's not all countries. It's just a segment of countries that are known to have very high levels of widespread transmission. Italy, South Korea. So those individuals, we ask them to stay inside for 2 weeks. If they develop symptoms during that period, call their healthcare provider. Now, the other, and then I'm happy to talk about the other aspects of McGinley's questions, but that's, I think, the most important thing for folks to remember if they are returning from travel to any of those level two or level, from any of those level two or level three countries.
The respirators, and I
just want to first commend you, McGinley, for taking steps ahead of the pack to keep people down east safe. It sounds as if, from what you said, you took these measures before a lot of other people across the country were doing so. And for that, I want to give you a shout out. Thank you for trying to keep people in your community safe. We recognize, again, that these measures are hard, and complying with them is a brand new thing. But the way I think about it is that it's our duty to one another. Even if you yourself are young, and even if you got coronavirus, you might be okay with it. What I don't want to happen is for a young person to go out to a bar and get exposed to coronavirus and then bring it back home to their elderly parents. So I really commend folks who are taking these recommendations seriously. Now, we are keeping track of some of the questions and the data that you asked, McGinley, about where are we on ventilators. For example, right now in the state of Maine, we've got roughly 300 ventilators. And about 220 or so are available. But if this situation really gets much worse, or it magnifies to a degree that a large number of people are affected, we know that we'll need more. Actually, the team at the Maine CDC has made an official request to the U.S. government for at least 300 more respirators. We know that we need to be prepared. So this is a concern. And as you noted, McGinley, a lot of folks do still have the idea that this is just the flu. And what we know is that it can be, for a lot of people, far more serious.
McGinley, thank you so much for your call. We do need to go to another quick break. This is a special two-hour Maine Calling. We have Dr. Nirav Shah from the Maine CDC on the line with us for the entire 2 hours. So many questions coming in, and we're going to try to get to as many as possible. We'll be right back.
Major support of Maine Calling's special coverage is provided by Northern Light Inland Hospital, offering care that's personal, convenient, and close to home. Learn more at mainemadeus.com/inland. The Lunder Foundation, in support of the Colby College Museum of Art, always free and open to all. And Breakwater in Portland, offering April vacation camp and summer day camp programs. Register at enrichment.breakwaterlearning.org. On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
On March 20th, 1852, Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin was published as a novel. Stowe wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin while living in Brunswick in 1851. The novel is credited with helping to spur on abolitionists and is cited among the causes of the American Civil War. The book sold 10,000 copies in its first week. Stowe was also a strong advocate of women's rights, religious tolerance, and educational reform. Stowe died in 1896.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of Roosevelt Campobello International Park and the Island Institute. Happy birthday, Maine!
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, we have the director of the Maine CDC with us today for a special two-hour program. Dr. Nirav Shah is here to answer your questions about the spread of coronavirus in Maine. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can also post a comment on today's Maine Calling Facebook post, tweet, or send an email, brief email, please, to talk@mainepublic.org. Talk@mainepublic.org. An email from Paul. He says, there's lots of talk about washing hands frequently. Should we avoid using and reusing cloth towels? Should we be using throwaway paper towels each time we wash our hands?
Great, great question, Paul. So let's talk about washing hands. And because the hand washing that we're talking about these days is a little bit more intense than the hand washing of 3 months ago. The best way that I have seen it described is as follows. I urge everyone to wash their hands as if they have just sliced a giant bag of jalapeno peppers and they now need to take their contact lenses out. That's the intensity with which I want everyone to wash their hands. That's the magic of hand washing is that the hot water, the flowing water, plus the friction of washing your hands and moving your hands together washes the virus away. In principle, that means that when you dry your hands on a towel, your hands don't have any viruses on it. But we know that's not always the case. Viruses can be hardy and still live. I don't think that we're at the point yet, rather, I don't know that we know enough yet to say you should not be using reusable cloth towels. But I do think it's fair to say that it's worthwhile to wash those cloth towels perhaps a bit more than you normally would.
All right, an email from Alan. What about produce in the grocery store? Wash it with detergent?
Well, certainly don't want to make your produce dangerous. So I think with respect to produce, the best rules here are to make sure you are washing it under running water for somewhat similar reasons. It's the water itself and the physical friction that is created that can wash the virus away. And then, of course, where possible, you want to be cooking the produce at a high temperature. But what I really want to emphasize here is the way in which coronavirus, this virus that we are talking about, is transmitted and spread. It is not contracted by eating. It is something that can be contracted by inhaling the virus deep within to your lungs, or alternately having the virus on your hands and maybe touching your face or touching your eye. It's not something that is transmitted through eating. That being said, it's always good practice in times like this to avoid as many, to adhere to as many good hygiene principles as possible. So it's always a good reminder to use this opportunity to wash your produce. If it helps you stay healthy for other reasons other than coronavirus, then it's a double win.
All right, we'll go to Brian, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Brian, go ahead.
Dr. Shaw, I trained at Memorial Sloan Kettering with Tony Fauci. He's a true gentleman and a very bright guy. He's losing his voice a little lately because of having to talk so much. I'm interested in the immunology of this disease, namely in those individuals who've recovered. Is there an immunologic profile, an antibody profile? The reason I ask is because having treated a couple of cancer patients experimentally with serum with high antibody count against certain malignancies, we did see a couple of remarkable responses. This was obviously highly experimental, but I just wonder whether or not it might be a worthwhile consideration to see if such a response might be elicited in someone who is otherwise mm-hmm. critically ill, for whom no other treatment is available, to use antibody-rich serum.
All right, Brian, thank you for your call, Dr. Shaw.
Well, Brian, what a great question. And first of all, just a pause on Dr. Anthony Fauci. He is right now a national treasure. And I've had the privilege of being on large group calls with my counterparts across the country and getting and had the honor and privilege to be briefed by Dr. Fauci several times over the past few months. And he really is truly a national treasure. I can think of no more trusted individual right now on these matters than Dr. Fauci. And I'm personally honored to have just been able to learn from him just over the past few months. So there are two questions that you raise that I think are exactly correct. The first is, what can we say about individuals who have recovered from coronavirus disease and their likelihood of getting it again, getting reinfected. And according to Dr. Fauci, there is no study yet that proves that once you've recovered, you cannot get it again. But based on everything that Dr. Fauci knows about coronaviruses generally, the likelihood of getting infected twice or getting reinfected is very, very, very low. That's a good sign. It means that as more and more people around the globe become recovered, their likelihood of harboring the virus, getting infected, and transmitting it to somebody else is very low. You raise a second question, though, that I have, again, also had the honor of listening to Dr. Fauci talk about, which is when someone becomes recovered and can't get the virus again, what that means on a scientific level is that their body has produced its own disease-fighting chemicals called antibodies, so that when their body gets exposed to that virus again, their own antibodies jump into action and take care of the virus. So one of the things that is being studied right now is using those individuals who have recovered and trying to get their antibodies to try to grab those antibodies from their blood and possibly use them to treat other individuals. Now, this is in the most early phases of research right now. It is too early to tell whether it will work for coronavirus. However, it has worked for other viruses. And indeed, that is actually the basis on which vaccination works. And it's also the basis under which a vaccine is being developed. Let's hope that our scientists, our leading lights like Dr. Fauci and his team, are able to make significant breakthroughs right now, because surely a treatment and a vaccine will be a real game changer here.
Brian, thank you so much for your call. I've got a number of similar emails and tweets coming in, and so I'm going to read a couple of them and then ask the question. Carl emails in, folks coming to Maine to escape harder hit areas should self-quarantine to make sure they're free from virus. And then a tweet here, what do we do about the influx of out-of-state folks and our healthcare facilities? They won't be able to take care of residents, never mind those folks. Many, many people concerned that there are people who are escaping to Maine from New York or other places where there are no more cases of coronavirus, whether they have summer homes here or just staying with family members.
Well, right now, there is no recommendation from the US CDC for anyone who's returning from travel from any other part of the United States. What I can say on a more general note, though, is that I've had the honor of living in Maine for 10 months now, and never have I lived in another part of the world that has been as welcoming, as open, as communal and congenial as the state of Maine is, and I hope that doesn't change.
All right, we're going to go to, let's see here, Rhonda in Belfast. Hi, Rhonda. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, thank you. First off, thank you for the show. I'm an acupuncturist here in Belfast, and I have closed my practice, and the Maine Acupuncture Association has recommended that all of us are doing that. And the biggest concern for me was, you know, I have hospital-grade disinfectant. I have, you know, all of those things that make me feel assured, and my clients feel assured that all surfaces and such are clear. But because people are asymptomatic and are still carriers, are still contagious. That was the biggest concern. And I would love to hear, I know we talked about that a little bit, about social distancing, but I want to talk about that asymptomatic part where, you know, you really don't know for a bit if you really are contagious. I know that's completely different than some of the other SARS epidemic and other things where once you had a fever, you were you became contagious, but now you don't even have to have a fever. So how? Let's talk about that for a few minutes. Maybe we can get deeper with that if that's possible.
Rhonda, thanks for your question. Dr. Shaw, what do we know about how this is transmitted among people who are asymptomatic?
Great. Rhonda, that is an excellent question, and you are on point. Just to go through the terms, what we mean by asymptomatic spread is the possibility that someone who doesn't have any of the symptoms we've been talking about, cough, fever, nausea, vomiting, could actually transmit the person, the virus. That is, as Rhonda notes, a little bit different from some viruses, where usually you have to be symptomatic in order to be sneezing in order to and then transmit it. But it's not different from all viruses. Even the flu can be transmitted before someone starts showing symptoms. So in that respect, it is something that we are used to dealing with. The reason why this asymptomatic piece is so important from a public health perspective is that it makes it more difficult for us to pinpoint who might have infected whom. In fact, just yesterday, Dr. Fauci, again, the same gentleman we referenced a moment ago, was discussing some data that are recently coming out showing that approximately 80% of cases of coronavirus got their infection from somebody who did not know that they were sick. Many of those folks were asymptomatic. So this asymptomatic piece really means that there could be folks who are capable of transmitting the virus, but who don't yet show symptoms. Just a couple of days ago, about 5 days ago, last weekend, there was additional research that came out that suggested that these folks who don't have symptoms might contribute to more spread. So this is a risk, and it is one of the things that makes coronavirus different from other viruses that cause widespread disease, like SARS, but it's a little bit more similar to the flu. But for that reason, and on the basis of that data that came out last weekend, the team at Maine CDC actually adjusted our practice based on the latest science. Now, when we work with folks, we don't ask them where they've been in the last 14 days. We actually now go back 2 additional days to account for the fact that they may have been transmitting it during the period before they were showing symptoms. Again, this is a fast-moving situation. When new science comes out, our team at Maine CDC does adjust. But Rhonda, you make a good point, and we're very much keeping tabs on this.
Rhonda, thanks so much for your call. We'll go to Kristen calling from Freeport. Hi, Kristen. Go ahead.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead.
So I'm an early childhood educator in Cumberland County. The center I work for has been in business for 30 years. Our director sought guidance from DHHS pretty early on, and especially when things started to really explode, you know, a week and a half ago, she was just on the fence about whether or not she should close. And there was nothing forthcoming, and she did make the decision finally to close our center for a minimum of 2 weeks. And that was very painful. She's putting her, you know, life's work on the line, basically. But I wanted to find out if Dr. Shaw is aware of and what his medical opinion is on the guidance that she did finally get. I actually think it came out like Friday or Saturday. Actually, it incentivizes and encourages centers to stay open. They are waiving the ratio requirements that are typically in place, and they're also allowing them.
Sure, Kristen, I'm sorry. We're getting to the top of the hour, so I just wanted to give Dr. Shaw a chance to respond to that. We did talk with the governor about it, and we're also going to be focusing on this Monday on Maine Calling childcare. But Dr. Shaw, in about a minute, if you could wrap up a response to Kristen.
Well, Kristen, these are very challenging decisions, and they also we have to make sure that we, of course, keep the health and welfare of children first and foremost. This is a situation where there are considerations, part of which are the fact that but early data that suggest that children are not as affected as adults, specifically young children. So there are many pieces in the air, and all of those go into trying to help us assess what decisions need to be made with respect to childcare providers. What I can say is that those decisions are always under review, and as new data come in, the entire team at the Department of Health and Human Services under Commissioner Lambrew are always taking a look at the best thing we should be doing for kids.
Kristen, thanks for your question. We are at the halfway point for today's show. This is a special two-hour Maine Calling program. I'm talking with Dr. Nirav Shah, Director of Maine Center for Disease Control and Prevention. We will be back to talk more about the coronavirus emergency in Maine and answer your questions after the newscast. Please stay with us. We'll return again after the news. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today's show is a special two-hour conversation with Dr. Nirav Shah, director of the Maine Center for Disease Control and Prevention. He is giving us the latest updates about the coronavirus situation in Maine, and he is here to answer your questions. If you have questions, you can email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or call us at 1-800-399-3566. We're trying to get to as many questions as possible. Very certain we will not get to them all, but we are making a really good effort. Dr. Shah, I want to start this hour with just a couple of the many compliments that are coming in to you through this crisis. Jody in South Portland says, just want to thank Dr. Shah for his exceptionally clear and kind communication. It helps a great deal. And this is from Marion. I am an older veterinarian in Lincolnville, having practiced for nearly 40 years. I have been following the thorough, compassionate, instructive information provided by Dr. Shah as this pandemic unfolds. I admire and applaud his competence, clarity, and kindness in his responses, and consistent efforts to invest Maine people in their own control over the spread of this virus. Furthermore, he does not ignore the bigger picture of the basic need for human companionship. So,
I am incredibly touched by that, and I'm honored to be able to serve the people of Maine. But I really want to make one thing really clear. If I am able to be here today talking to everybody and being in a position to see far into this, it is because I have the luxury and the privilege of standing on the shoulders of giants who are my team at the Maine CDC, the Department of Health and Human Services, and the entire administration, and everybody in the healthcare and public health infrastructure in the state of Maine. And I have been so honored to be able to work with them and learn from them and stand on their shoulders. And all of those folks are working in concert with one another right now to make sure that the state of Maine is as prepared as we can be. And I really, truly salute and thank them for all of their work.
We're going to go to Margaret, who's calling from Waterville. Hi, Margaret. You're on Maine Call with Dr. Shah.
Hi. Thank you very much. My question is about what you, Dr. Shah, and the CDC do when epidemiologically after someone has been identified as being infected with the coronavirus. I'm asking that because I'm part of a large group of seniors that until last Friday participated in a seniors walk program at Colby College. We found out this morning that someone from the athletic department has been confirmed as being infected. And so I'm wondering, will you investigate who this person was exposed to? And if so, will you contact us? Because we were in the facility, the athletic facility.
That is a great question. I'm so happy to be able to pull back the curtain a little bit on the work that our disease detectives, our gumshoe epidemiologists, are doing on a day-to-day basis. When the Maine CDC receives word that there has been a positive test for coronavirus, maybe it's from our laboratory, or maybe it's from one of the other commercial laboratories or hospital laboratories in the state that are doing the test, they're required to report that result to us. We receive those reports usually in the very early morning and review them first thing. We then assign them out to one of our field epidemiologists. These are the disease detectives, the gumshoes out there, who then make contact with the individual person who we've gotten a positive result from. And we sit down, or they sit down, and talk to that person and go through everywhere they've been in the past 16 days. Now, I don't know about you, but I can barely remember where I had lunch the other day, let alone where I was 14 and a half days ago and who I met with. But our disease detectives work with them to try to reconstruct the past 16 days of their lives. And we identify what we really focus on are close contacts, what the U.S. CDC defines as sustained contact within a close period. And we develop a list of those close contacts, and then that same disease detective reaches out to those folks. So if you just happen to pass by somebody in the hallway, that is, based on the science we have, not a sufficient intensity of contact in which to transmit or contract coronavirus. But if you had lunch with somebody for several hours and you were face-to-face with them, that's somebody that we would then reach out to and ask that person to take a look at their own symptoms for perhaps stay inside their house for 14 days. And then we check in on those people on an ongoing basis. That's really what our disease detectives are doing day in and day out with even greater intensity now working with coronavirus.
Margaret, thanks for your call. A whole bunch of people asking questions about face masks. I'll go to this email from Barb. Why isn't the CDC recommending face masks for everyone while they're in public places? This would protect people on both sides of the mask.
Great. So there are a few reasons. The first is, let's just chat about the different types of face masks. There are really two large categories of face masks. One are the more standard surgical masks that you might see on TV and the kind that you can sometimes find at the pharmacy. The other category of face masks are what are called N95s. These are very specialized technical masks that you have to actually undergo a process to be fit tested for before you can actually use it. So the face masks that we're talking about right now are these more typical standard surgical masks. And what we know about them is that they are really good at protecting people who are sick from expelling or propelling those respiratory droplets out into the air. But if you're not sick and you're just worried about protecting your own self, these masks really don't do a great job of preventing you from inhaling the droplets. So if somebody has been diagnosed with coronavirus, we ask them to stay inside, to not go outside at all. So they really don't need to have a mask on because they shouldn't be outside in the first place. And for folks who don't have coronavirus, who are just looking to try to stay safe, based on the science we know, those masks don't really prevent you from inhaling the virus. The other piece to really keep in mind is that right now, based on where we are in the United States, all of these pieces of protective equipment are precious resources. And we really want to make sure that healthcare providers, EMS personnel, those folks that are on the front line, that we preserve as many of those masks as possible for them so that they can put them on patients when they're working with patients in the field or in the hospital.
A couple follow-up questions, though. What if you know, we've mentioned in this program that somebody may be asymptomatic but able to spread coronavirus. What if somebody thinks, I don't think I have it, but I might, and I have a mask, why not just wear it?
If somebody thinks they might have coronavirus, the best thing for them to do is to stay inside. The mask, it might be useful, but people who are spreading it asymptomatically may not even, they don't have symptoms. They're not coughing. They're typically not sneezing. So if someone feels that they are about to start getting sick, and we've all had that feeling, boy, I'm about 12 hours away from not feeling so hot. The best thing to do is to stay inside. Right now, of course, the recommendation for the most part is for folks to avoid large groups. So those types of close interactions shouldn't be occurring. But if you feel like you're not 100%, the best thing to do is to stay inside. And then we don't really have to go into whether the mask is useful or when to put the mask on and who should be tested. The best remedy right there is to just stay inside and avoid that physical contact, the physical distancing that we talk about.
Several questions also about homemade masks. I'll go to this one, which is an email from Louise. I have become aware of health facilities in other areas putting out requests for homemade masks as per their instructions. Are you aware of this being a need at facilities here in Maine, as there are many sewers at home who could help with that?
You know, we keep sewing is my ask. There are actually guidelines on the sewing and the knitting or the creation of homemade masks. Where we are right now with these surgical masks is that the supply is ample. It's sufficient, I should say. But this is a situation with an outbreak like this where we don't know where the world may take us in a couple of days, let alone a couple of weeks. So there are guidelines out there on how to manufacture these masks at home, how to sew them. And so if folks are looking to do their part and you have a talent for sewing, one never knows in which we may need to call folks up and start sewing masks. So I'm not going to deny anybody their opportunity to join the force and do their part.
An email from Diana. I'm wondering if I can continue to swim at the YWCA without catching the virus.
Well, based on the way that the virus is transmitted, it does really rely on this close contact and inhaling respiratory droplets. So the answer here is a bit more challenging. One is that I think right now most gymnasiums, pools, public areas of that sort are actually closed in Maine per the governor's directive. But more generally speaking, if you happen to be in a lane by yourself in a pool with no one else around, the chlorine levels in the water are sufficient, based on what we know right now, are sufficient to keep the viral load levels down. But if you happen to be in a pool and you're sharing lanes and you're lap circling with a lot of other people around, this may be a time to put swimming on hold and maybe look for a trail to walk on.
And most swimming pools also in Maine are indoors, and there's locker rooms to think about.
The same factors apply there in the locker room as well. You're absolutely right, Jennifer. That close contact in small areas with poor ventilation indoors, those are the areas where we're really looking to introduce physical distance into. And what I want to say about all this is again, I recognize how stark some of these recommendations are. I fully appreciate and acknowledge that. But one of the things about pandemics is that everything you do before a pandemic hits seems like an overreaction. And then everything you do after the pandemic hits seems like it was inadequate and too late. So if these recommendations seem stark, if they seem jarring, if they even seem extreme, the real way that I like to think about them is that they are aggressive, so that we don't look back on this and say, boy, we should have done more. Again, everything you often, in situations, whether that be an emergency, a pandemic, an outbreak, everything you do before seems like an overreaction. But then looking back on it, everything can seem like it was too late and inadequate.
An email from Helen. A friend who has to fly is worried about the air inside a plane, which he says is recirculated and thus puts him at risk for COVID-19. On a Maine Calling program earlier this week, a guest, a doctor, said turning on the air and blowing it full force into your face is good protection. Is my friend or your expert right?
Well, the CDC guidance with respect, the U.S. CDC's guidance with respect to traveling right now is that if you are older, if you have chronic health conditions, this may not be the best time to fly, but it really does depend on what your age is and how healthy you are at baseline. Flying for many folks is a necessity. However, if it can be avoided, this would be a good time to rethink that. If you're not sure whether flying is appropriate for you right now, this is a good time to give your doctor's office a call. The guidance from the US CDC does change quite frequently. There's not a blanket prohibition on flying whatsoever. But what we do know is that the virus is circulating. And even if you leave aside the business about air circulating and whether in your face is better or around you is better, you may still be in very close proximity to individuals who may not be feeling well, even forgetting about the air circulation issue. So this is a time to reconsider those events. Think about what your doctor's office might tell you based on your own health status, your age, and other chronic conditions you might have.
Lori on Facebook writes, I am a UMaine researcher that may have reagents or supplies that you may need. How can we share?
Well, we have reached out to different laboratories at the University of Maine, as well as other universities, as well as private research and other laboratories across the state. What I would offer to that individual is that the best thing for them to do, without going too far into the weeds, is to reach out to the district liaison for their area of the state of Maine. Their district liaison for whichever branch of the campus they may be on can be found on the Maine CDC's website. Shoot that person a note, and then our lab team can take a look at whether the reagents that are in your lab could be utilized at our laboratory. I am so appreciative for that outreach. When we put out the call for assistance to some of those private partners, public partners, and other entities, the response was overwhelming. And I think it speaks volumes about the spirit of the people of Maine, that when situations of this sort have arisen, people answer the call to help. For me personally, it's moving. It really is moving, because it underscores the fact that none of us is doing this alone. We are all in this together, and I commend everyone for their offers of assistance.
We'll go to Peter calling from Brunswick. Hi, Peter. You're on Maine Calling with Dr. Shaw.
Great. Thank you. My question is, actually, I'd comment first on the face masks. If there's not a shortage of masks, it just seems to me that in the near future, people should be wearing them more regularly so that they're not transmitting. You know, just my walk around Brunswick and Home Depot, and it just seems practical that we would be wearing masks if this crisis does continue to increase, and that we're not so that we're not releasing it from our space around our head. But so there's that piece. If there is a mask shortage, but my question has to do with my son. One of my boys is coming home in a few weeks. He's out in Colorado, and I think he's going to be flying. He has plane tickets, but he's concerned about infecting us. I'm 61. My wife's 57. We're healthy. And we're just trying to alleviate his fears, you know, that it could be, you know, it'd be fine. But what are some recommendations if you have someone coming into your house, like a young 20-year-old, to protect, or he can't isolate, but what can we do to keep down exposure, or should we just tell them to stay out in Colorado to ride it out?
Well, Peter, yeah, your question is a question so many people have. Almost every college in America is sending its students home.
Mm-hmm. And when they send them home to other people that they might be in contact with. Peter, I would ask you guys to think about a couple of things. The first is that when other people, maybe not your son, but others are coming over, perhaps your son's friends, if they're not feeling well, I would ask them not to come in. This is a time where we are in the country where I think it is okay to say, hey, if you're not feeling great, I'd rather you not come in right now. And I don't think there's anything untoward about that, even if it is a bit jarring. I go back to what I said earlier. Everything we do before might seem like an overreaction, but on the other side, it seems sensible. So that's the first thing. But of course, your son's coming back too. If he's not feeling well, I think even within a small household, it's possible to have people maintain some distance from each other. Have your son stay in the room and try to keep others, especially others who might have chronic health conditions, away from your son. So there are steps, even within a household, that folks can take to minimize the risk of infection. It's difficult in this setting, and I acknowledge that we can't eliminate that risk. I wish we could, but there are steps, even within a household, to minimize that risk and keep it as low as possible.
Peter, thanks so much for your call. We do need to take a quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions for Dr. Nirav Shah of the Maine CDC. This is a special 2-hour Maine Calling program on Maine Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Major support of Maine Calling's special coverage is provided by the Cedars, a nonprofit senior living community in Portland since 1929, offering independent living at the atrium. TheCedarsPortland.org. The Dempsey Center, making life better for people managing the impact of cancer. Locations in Lewiston and South Portland. DempseyCenter.org. And Lee Auto Malls. We're grateful for the service and dedication of Maine's healthcare professionals.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, we're taking a deep look at the way the coronavirus pandemic has rippled through every aspect of our lives, seemingly in a matter of weeks. Whether you're working from home, not working, or have to go to work, COVID-19 has changed everything. We'll trace those ripple effects next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
And that's coming up tomorrow afternoon at 2 and Sunday evening at 11 here on Maine Public Radio. With coronavirus social distancing practices now in place all around our state, you may find that you have young ones around the house more than usual. Might we suggest a couple of valued educational resources that will make the time worthwhile? Maine Public's PBS Kids 24/7 television channel is a wonderful learning environment with trusted educational non-commercial programming for those younger folks. And PBS Learning Media is a free online educational K-12 learning resource with materials and lessons for children and young adults of all ages. You'll find PBS Learning Media at mainepublic.org. Please click on the education drop-down and enjoy.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Dr. Nirav Shah with the Maine Center for Disease Control and Prevention is here discussing the latest on COVID-19 in Maine and taking your questions. This is a special two-hour Maine Calling. You can join the conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. An email from John: what is the effect of cold weather on the spread of COVID-19? And this is sort of reflective of something we're hearing about, you know, how weather in general has an effect on the spread of the virus.
It's a great question, and it's a good scientific question. There are some folks in the scientific and virology community who believe that the warmer weather and the warmer months may play an impact on the virus's ability to spread. Other folks don't believe that. For my own part, I look at the fact that the virus is spreading pretty quickly in parts of the world right now that are experiencing their summer: Singapore, Malaysia, Australia. So I'm not putting a lot, it's impossible to know. And like all scientific questions, we won't know until all the data are in. But for my part, I'm not planning anything about the state of Maine's response based on a hypothesis or a theory. We are planning as if the virus will continue to circulate regardless of what the scientific findings are for the summer. Again, it's an interesting scientific question. Like all scientific questions, it's impossible to know the answer until all the data are in. But given the circulation of the virus right now in parts of the world that are experiencing their summers, sub-Saharan Africa, Singapore, et cetera, we in Maine are not banking on a hypothesis.
Okay, we'll go to Joe, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Joe. You're on with Dr. Shah. Go ahead.
Hi. Wonderful program. Thank you so much. I'm 83. I've done self-isolation, but I own an N95 mask, and I wore it to the grocery store. Can I use it again?
Yes. However, The one thing to note about these N95 masks that many people do have if they've worked in fields like construction or the chemical industry is that they have to be what is called fit tested. That is the process of taking the mask and adjusting it so that the seal of the mask around your face doesn't allow for any air to come in. So while the N95 is an exquisite way to reduce the likelihood of inhaling that virus, unless that fit testing is done, the N95 mask isn't much different from a regular surgical mask. So, Joe, if you have somebody that you know who is certified in order to do that fit testing, that would be the time to do it. What I can, so it's a challenge, and although the masks can be very good, the testing and the fitting of the mask is just as vital as having the mask in the first instance.
All right, Joe, thank you for your question. A couple questions about what to do if you don't have a doctor. This one's from Star. How are people who don't have a doctor or insurance to get tested? And if they're infected, how do they get treatment?
What a great question. We anytime we think about public health, one of our mantras in public health is equity, health equity. And so we don't just think about the disease and the math and the numbers. We also think about the differential impact that any situation, in this case, coronavirus, the differential impact that that will have among the least advantaged of us. In this situation, we're concerned about a couple of groups. Let's start with those who have underinsurance or uninsurance. We've been working with federally qualified health centers to make sure that they are equipped to do testing as well as treatment of individuals. There's more work to be done there. I acknowledge that. But we are hoping to be able to have a network of federally qualified health centers across the state that can work with individuals who are underinsured or uninsured. And I want to take a second here to commend the federally qualified health centers and their organization for their willingness to work with us. This is a big challenge because of the need for protective equipment, et cetera. And I just want to take a second to really thank them for their partnership as we continue to work this through. Another group that we're worried about are folks that live far away from any of those centers. And so we're thinking about ways to get them testing as well as care as well. So health equity remains top of mind for us.
Andrew in Unity, go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hello. I had a similar question. I am symptomatic and isolated. I did get tested yesterday, but I don't have a primary care provider to relay the news to me. So I'm hoping that the lab might call. And also, if I have a positive test result and I make it through fine, will I then have antibodies and be immune to the virus?
Great question. Based on everything we know about the science right now, once you make it come out on the other side of this, which, again, approximately 80% of people have mild symptoms. After that point, based on everything we know about this virus, you will have immunity or the antibodies, as you noted, at the end of that. Now, there is not a study that proves that. So as with many things in life, there are different ways of knowing something. But in this case, the way we know that is based on every other thing we know about this family of viruses. So after someone is recovered, we believe that their recovery will give them immunity. In the same way that vaccines generate immunity, the virus itself can do so. So we wish you the best of luck. I'm hoping you get results soon. And if they are positive, I wish nothing but the best for you. And I wish you a speedy recovery.
Andrew, you too. An email from Shad. I was hoping Dr. Shaw could give guidance for healthcare workers, specifically high contact frontline healthcare workers, ED, ICU, first responders, about a protocol or procedure they can follow before and after working a shift to minimize getting ill or spreading the virus. More specifically, Maine CDC can give guidance on systems or protocols hospitals and healthcare facilities can provide to their workers and then individual actions healthcare professionals can perform to minimize transmission to their families.
Great. Let's take those let's take each group separately. The workers themselves, healthcare workers, particularly those frontline healthcare workers, the nurses, the emergency room technicians, the EMTs who are on the front line dealing with folks and helping them in the field, they are the backbone of our healthcare system. And protecting them as a force is a priority for us. They are, in fact, one of the groups that we have prioritized as areas of focus for our work. The recommendations for healthcare workers are a fewfold. The first is that if you are working with any particular patient who has the signs and symptoms of coronavirus, make sure you don the appropriate protective equipment. That's the masks that we've been talking about, the N95s. If you have not yet been fit tested for an N95 by your institution, please pursue an opportunity to do so. The other thing on the healthcare system piece, we've been working with healthcare systems to help them put into place guidance to do two things. The first is keep their own healthcare workers safe. In other parts of the country, some institutions are instituting temperature checks when people come on shift and when they come off shift to protect them as healthcare workers, as well as the patients that they interact with. One of the concerns that we have, that I have at the Maine CDC, is to prevent coronavirus from becoming what it is right now, which is largely travel associated, to prevent it from becoming travel associated, to hospital associated. If healthcare workers fall ill, the ability of those employees to provide good care for Maine people will be compromised. It also raises the possibility that those same employees could transmit the disease to patients. Neither is a scenario that we want, and that's why healthcare workers are one of our groups of high focus right now.
Pat on Facebook asks a question a lot of people are asking. Is it accurate that ibuprofen should not be used if you have COVID-19 symptoms? Similar questions being asked about acetaminophen.
That is a great question. There were some research and data that were published and noted by the World Health Organization just a few days ago about ibuprofen, which also goes by names like Advil and Motrin. According to the World Health Organization, if you have the signs and symptoms of COVID-19, again, cough, fever, shortness of breath, it is better right now to avoid ibuprofen, which goes by the names of Advil and Motrin. Out of an abundance of caution, that is what the World Health Organization's recommendation is. In place, acetaminophen, which goes by the name Tylenol, seems to be an alternative. That is based on very early research, and those findings might change. We might be in a place in a few weeks from now where ibuprofen is okay based on newer data. It's just evidence of how quickly things change. But right now, according to the WHO, acetaminophen is slightly preferred over ibuprofen.
An email from John. The CDC reports to date in other countries, places that close schools, for example, Hong Kong, have not had more success in reducing spread than those that did not, including Singapore. Considering all the potential harms that can arise from closing schools, why isn't the government encouraging schools to remain open?
The essence of school closure is not whether to do it, but when to do it. What the best research shows is that when school closure is enacted before community transmission, there is a benefit to it. After community transmission has set in, the value of closing schools is less clear. Here in Maine, the recommendation to close schools made by the governor was right before or right around the same time that one part of the state, Cumberland County, began seeing early signs of community transmission. In other parts of the world where school closures were enacted, it was often after the fact. At that point, when community transmission has already set in, the horse is not even out of the barn, but it's on the farm next door. So the essence and the discussion and the calculus behind school closure really depends on when it is done, not so much whether it is done.
An email from Wynn. One very important subject that is largely missing from the news are the statistics on recovery. If just new and confirmed cases and deaths are given prominence, then our spirits will be diminished. We also need to know what recovery means. Does it confer immunity? You've already talked about that, but why don't we talk about the recovery? How many people who contract COVID-19 are fine afterwards?
That is a great question, because recovery is important not just for epidemiological reasons, but for psychological reasons as well. This is a situation where recovery is possible. Hope is on the horizon, but it's going to take a lot of these physical distancing efforts to get us there. Now, the numbers on recovery, as are the numbers of cases, are in flux all the time. In Maine right now, there's one individual I'm able to report who has recovered. We hope that those numbers rise as more and more folks recover themselves. But this is a situation where recovery is possible from the disease. There are various different websites out there, often by universities, research groups, and others, that are tracking these numbers in somewhat close to real time, that are providing, as Wynn noted, not just the number of cases and, sadly, the number who have passed, but also the number who have recovered. And that's a number that we keep an eye on for epidemiological purposes because of some of the immunity questions we've talked about. But again, it's just as important for psychological purposes. Recovery is possible. And because of these physical distancing measures that we're recommending, we're hoping we get to those numbers pretty soon.
It is time for another quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions for Dr. Nirav Shah. You're listening to a special two-hour edition of Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Major support of Maine Calling's special coverage is provided by New England Rehabilitation Hospital of Portland, helping patients and their families after illness or injury. Learn more at nerhp.org. And McVetti's Hearth and Home, offering outdoor patio furniture, grills, and wood swing sets. Showroom in Yarmouth. More at stovesofmaine.com.
COVID-19 upends daily life, our economy, and our elections.
It's important that the DNC recognize not the politics of this, but the public safety. That is a growing concern.
Politics and governing in the time of a pandemic. That's next time on Takeaways Politics with Amy Walter from WNYC and PRX.
And that's coming up later this evening at 7 here on Maine Public Radio. During times like this, you want reliable news, the truth, a trusted source for your information. That's why you're listening to Maine Public Radio. And that's why you also might appreciate Maine Public Television. Each evening between 5 and 6, there's a full hour of BBC News with a global perspective on the top news of the day. Following that at 6, there's the PBS NewsHour, which is also available at 7 each evening. A full hour in-depth analysis of the day's events and issues. The Maine Public Television early evening news block schedule can be seen at mainepublic.org. Please click on the television drop-down to see it.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today, our program is a two-hour special. We're talking with Dr. Nirav Shah with Maine CDC, addressing your questions about coronavirus. I'm going to go to an email from Martha. There are many similar questions coming in, Dr. Shah. She writes, my mother is 90, well, but with comorbidities, and lives in independent senior congregate living. What factors should our family consider as we decide the pros and cons of whether to extract her to live with one of us should one of her neighbors test positive for COVID-19? We have several questions also from Ocean View and Falmouth, where somebody has or more than one person has tested positive. Is it safer to stay in a independent living or assisted living facility, or is it safer to come out and live with a member of your family?
Well, Jennifer, this is something that I've thought quite a lot about, and unfortunately, there's not an easy answer. The intuition in many of these situations, the instinct is to remove loved ones from those settings. But we also always have to ask, remove them to where? There is a phenomenon in the literature that's been described about how when individuals who live in settings of that nature are moved to new locations, they can have challenges adapting. If for no other reason than, for example, when they get up in the middle of the night, they're not used to the facility that they're in, the new place that they're in, and they can, for example, take a fall. So the challenge of when to move a loved one to balance out the need to be in a stable community where they know their surroundings versus being in another community is very difficult. What I can say is that there are a few factors. The first is that if the loved one can avoid some type of congregant setting, group meal settings, things of that nature, that's one positive step. The other consideration is to ask how much spread is going on at the baseline in the community already. So in Cumberland County right now, we have seen and detected what we call community transmission. So moving an individual from one location in Cumberland County to another location in Cumberland County may not change their risk. But the third thing that I think is really important for everybody, seniors or not seniors, is the risk of becoming socially isolated. Many people who live in congregant living settings, assisted living, independent living facilities, they have a community. And by moving them away from their community, we may impose that physical distancing, but we might replace it with social isolation. Balancing those factors is very difficult. I don't have any easy answers. I don't have an equation or a piece of calculus that we could run some numbers on that spits out an answer. I wish I did. It's been something that's been weighing on my mind quite a lot. I do ask everyone to think about these things, to prepare for this discussion, but based on where we are right now, I recognize fully how difficult the decision is on a family-by-family basis.
Twitter, what are you doing for very rural areas of Maine? They are not testing in rural areas, and hospitals are not prepared.
That's exactly right. When we talked a little while ago about health equity, we take into account a number of factors that drive health equity. Some of them are insurance rates or insurance coverage, but others of them are just geography. Areas of rural Maine have challenges twofold. The first is that testing sites, even if they are available, are more distant. And then the hospitals may not be as equipped as tertiary care hospitals to care for patients. At the same time, there are epidemiological factors that, because of lower population density, make the likelihood of rapid spread or exponential growth a little bit less likely. So there's factors on both sides. Right now, what we're focused on is trying to find ways to stand up a network of clinics, these federally qualified health centers, and then augment that where possible with additional workers, for example, our public health nurses, who can work on testing. Those plans are still being developed right now. So we absolutely recognize the challenge that is faced by folks in non-urban parts of the state. It's something that we are working on right now. It is certainly an area that we're focused on and concerned about. No question about it.
So a whole bunch of questions that are related. One about receiving a box in the mail. Another, a tweet, so much mixed info on how long this virus can live on a surface without a host. Can this be cleared up, please? And then also related, Peg on Facebook, is it okay to cook for an elderly person and drop off food? Do we need to worry about transmission that way? So all of those questions, I think, about surfaces as opposed to surfaces that might move from one place to another. There were the ones dropping off a box or dropping off food or something else.
Great. So let's start with the first set and then get to the cooking question. There are new data that have come out about the longevity of this virus on surfaces. And some of those data came out just a couple of days ago. One of them was actually from Dr. Fauci's own lab. And it does appear that the coronavirus can persist on different surfaces for some period of time, several hours. But what Dr. Fauci himself has counseled is that that is under perfect laboratory conditions. Of course, the real world is not the same as perfect laboratory conditions. And so the way that he and other virus scientists interpret those data is that under perfect laboratory conditions, even though it might be theoretically possible to spread or transmit or pick up the virus from one surface to another, it's probably not anything that contributes to massive outbreaks. This, again, really underscores the importance, though, of washing your hands as intensely as possible and cleaning surfaces in and around your home. There's more research ongoing about how long the virus can persist, but if you wash your surfaces, you use an approved cleaner, and you wash your hands, whatever that longevity of that virus is greatly reduced. Now, cooking for elderly folks, this is a great question. I encourage folks to do that. I encourage folks to cook for their neighbors in general. Right now, I encourage everyone to be kind and take care of their neighbors.
Just wash your hands, right?
Wash your hands, prepare the food as if you were going to serve it to your own mother or grandmother, package it up, and deliver it to the neighbors, perhaps on their doorstep, to minimize that contact with vulnerable folks.
And another related question we have has to do with things like playgrounds, outdoor equipment, benches and playgrounds. Is that a place where a virus will survive?
Well, you know, this kind of goes back to the difference between the real life world and the perfect laboratory world. In the perfect laboratory conditions, the virus can persist. But under conditions of real life, a playground with lots of friction, people coming and going, it's not yet known how long the virus can persist. Those studies are underway. But what I understand from health experts at the US CDC and the National Institute for Health is that even if some degree of persistence or longevity is possible by the virus on surfaces, it's not something that's known to drive a high number of cases. Again, it's all the more reason we should all be careful. We should be washing our hands. But what we know about virus survival right now and transmission is that the principal mode of transmission for this virus is through those respiratory droplets from sneezing or coughing in close proximity rather than by touching a rail.
All right. We'll go to Kevin, who's calling from Eco, Maine. Hi, Kevin. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer, and thanks for the program. Kevin Roach from Eco, Maine. We provide an essential service. Basically, we take the trash from 72 member communities and also the recyclable materials. Can you imagine if that trash started piling up at everybody's home or at the hospitals or at the commercial establishments? We've been very aggressive with documenting every 6- and 3-foot encounter, and we have actually a form that every employee fills out to document the frequency of that encounter and the duration. The question that I have is, you mentioned before earlier in the show about duration. If it's a passing by, do we really need to document that as an encounter? And what should be an encounter, an official documented encounter? Should it be 30 seconds, 5 seconds? And we do this for our own awareness to cut down on these encounters. But also in the event that we do have a positive test, we're hoping that we can use this to see who's been exposed.
Wow. So first of all, kudos to you for taking these proactive steps. When we talk about prevention, in prevention in the setting of outbreaks, this is quite exemplary. And again, you know, for many people in your community, they may think this is an overreaction, but after something hits, it will be seen as prescient. So congrats. Now, in terms of your specific, one other observation as well, what outbreaks like this really reveal is what we mean by essential in our workforce, because you and your colleagues are essential. If your workforce is depleted or out, the implications could ripple across Maine society. So thank you for that as well. Now, to your specific questions, what is meant by a close encounter is an encounter of 15 minutes or more within usually about a 2-meter distance, so about 6 feet. And it's a pretty close encounter. So sitting next to somebody at dinner, sitting across from them at a job interview, something of that nature. It is not thought to be passing by someone in the hallway for a couple of seconds and waving at them and having a 10-second conversation. It really is more sustained and more close.
Kevin, thanks for your call. A Facebook post from Andrew. I'm curious about the director's assertion that testing isn't reliable until a patient is showing symptoms. My understanding of how other countries, like South Korea, have stopped their outbreaks is that they did it by broadly testing members of the general public. Are they doing a different kind of test, or is it just that they have more supplies and can afford to test more people? I'm also curious about the incubation time. I've heard from many sources that the incubation time is 2 to 14 days with an average of 5, but how certain are we of that?
Great. Let's start with the incubation period. The incubation period refers to the time between when someone is exposed to the virus and when they start developing symptoms. It varies for every different virus and bacteria out there. Based on the data that we have right now for coronavirus, it is thought to be approximately 4 to 6 days. And we derive or learn about that incubation period through observational studies. We study a large group of people who have the virus, and then those same gumshoe epidemiologists, those disease detectives that I talked about earlier, ask them, who have you been in contact with? When were you in contact with them? And then when did you first start developing symptoms? And from that, we can back channel it and try to get an estimate of that incubation period. Based on what we know right now, it's about 4 to 6 days. But out of an abundance of caution, the US CDC asks state health departments to go all the way to 14 days just to make sure we capture that. In fact, our department at the Maine CDC is going back 16 days. How confident are we of that? Well, it's science. Based on what we see when data come in, we adjust. early on, the numbers were unknown, and so we based our numbers on what was known about coronaviruses. But after initial studies started being published, we had a better range, and they've largely equalized around this 4 to 6 day period. Now, with respect to testing, the test itself is accurate. What we are talking about in this situation is what to do with results. So if someone is completely asymptomatic and we test them and they test positive, well, we have good reason to think that they've got the virus and we can put them in some sort of isolation. We may never know whether they would have ever developed symptoms or whether they would have ever infected anybody. The concern about testing individuals who don't have symptoms is not what happens if they're positive, but rather what we would do if they are negative. Because again, they may have just been exposed an hour before the test was drawn. And so how should we think about negative tests? Should we put everybody who is tested under some period of quarantine? Or should we wait until they have actually developed symptoms? But if we wait until that long, it might be too late. So the challenge when we think about any kind of test is not whether to test, but when to test so we get the most actionable results.
All right. Well, Dr. Shaw, thank you so much for being here for this 2-hour program today and for helping people get answers to their questions. Dr. Nirav Shaw is director of Maine Center for Disease Control and Prevention. And Dr. Shaw, let me ask you this. You know, even though you answered so many questions, there are so many more coming in. Where would somebody send questions? Is there, I know that your staff is working so hard. Is there a central place?
Well, the best place that I would ask folks, so let me start here, Jennifer. We are at a point with this outbreak where fear and misinformation can spread more quickly than the virus itself. So staying informed is something that I ask everybody to do. The first place to go is to the US CDC's website and the Maine CDC's website. We have a wealth of information there. If you're not able to find an answer to your question there, you can call the Maine CDC, but the best place to call first is 211. We work with 211 to give them updates on where things are, and they are equipped to handle most general questions about the virus. I do ask that everyone does two things. Please stay informed to prevent that fear and misinformation from spreading. And the other thing is to please be kind to one another and take care of all your neighbors.
Well, Dr. Shaw, thank you so much. Again, Dr. Nirav Shaw, director of Maine's Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. We had additional help from John Bradford, Dan Work, Scott McCollum, and John Keimel. Today's show will be rebroadcast at 8 this evening. We will also air it again tomorrow, Saturday, at noon. You can always find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as helpful links and resources at mainecalling.org. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. And a programming note, we will continue to produce 2-hour Maine Calling programs next week to address the pressing questions facing our state and how it's being affected by coronavirus. If you have questions about COVID-19, please leave us a voicemail. That number, 207-370-3487. Monday's program will be about the challenges facing childcare during this crisis, and we will also talk about working from home. Again, to leave us a voicemail, 370-3487. Please visit the Maine Calling website or Facebook page for ways to contact us about upcoming shows or to leave us a message. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.